The first book of St. John Cassian's Institutes is modeled very closely on the introduction to the Practikos of Evagrius Ponticus. It includes a symbolic description of the elements of the monastic habit, which is also supposed to provide an introduction to the basic understanding of monastic life itself, of what ascetical renunciation is supposed to contain. This will give you some idea in comparing this text with Evagrius in how Cassian adapts and modifies Evagrius' material. Evagrius' goal was to put into very succinct, simple sentences texts which could be memorized and pondered within the heart. That doesn't seem to be the case with Cassian because his texts are very long. They're not really intended for so much memorization as perhaps for being read out or pondered over a long period of time. They are effectively much more expanded developments of thoughts that one finds in Evagrius, and in some cases the very expansion often goes off in different directions and doesn't have quite the direct focus that one finds in Evagrius. Now, that isn't to say that Cassian is somehow inferior. On the contrary, Cassian, as Father de Vogüé would say, in many ways completes and develops, even humanizes and adapts a monastic system that he inherits from Evagrius and allows it to be something that can very powerfully be lived out in a new context. So Cassian has been living monastic life for many decades. He was, as we've mentioned, he was trained in Egypt, then eventually after exile and traveling found himself in Gaul, and there writes these institutes and also the conferences for the sake of those who want to live monastic life, looking towards the model of ancient Egypt, of the monastic tradition from Egypt, which several decades before was at its high point and its golden age. Cassian wants to emphasize how it needs to be learned from, but at the same time how important it is that it be modified. And so that in particular is what we're going to focus in on from this section, from the first 11 chapters, from the whole of the book one of the Institutes, and that's the possibility of modifying the tradition that one receives. You'll see also that there are interior links periodically in this page that will allow you to go back and forth between Cassian's text and the Evagrian material on which it seems to be based. Now, whether Cassian actually had a text of the Practikos before him when he wrote this is uncertain and perhaps even a little doubtful. More likely, he knew it extremely well, and he was in a kind of a free sort of way, reflecting on its structure and outline, and then adapting it. As we'll see, just as Evagrius and the Practikos first describes the monastic habit and then goes on to describe the vices and virtues, in the same way, Cassian in the first part of the Institutes gives a symbolic description of the habit, and then after in chapters books 2 and 3 describing the prayer practices of the Egyptians, in 4 again returns to Evagrius' model of the Practikos and introduces in a kind of a slow way what will comprise the rest of the Institutes, and that's a discussion of the 8 deadly thoughts. Well, let's look at, to a very limited extent, what Cassian has done with this symbolism of the habit. He points out in chapter 1 on the monk's cincture that this is a way of understanding how monasticism stands in the ancient tradition on the one hand of the apostles and in even greater and more remote antiquity that of Elijah and Elisha. So the monastic habit is a kind of solidarity, an experience of living out again the life of the prophets of old, especially Elijah, but then also John the Baptist. Then in chapter 2, in which he particularly talks about a kind of general sense of what the habit is about, he talks about some of the monastic virtues. The fact in number 2.2 that one is to be seeking for a humility rather than for vanity. And in 2.3, he talks about the importance of the monastic habit not being simply a means of penance. he, Cassian, and he says his teachers in Egypt utterly disapproved of penitential garments that simply were for the purpose, visible purpose, of torturing the flesh. He didn't believe, he doesn't believe in sackcloth robes as at all appropriate. He says, they utterly disapproved of them, in number 2-3. They being his Egyptian teachers, they did not think sackcloth robes, which are visible to all and conspicuous, are at all appropriate, and even more so, they're inconvenient, and they're unsuitable for the performance of necessary work, and a monk ought to be ready and unimpeded to engage in work. So there's a beautiful kind of practical wisdom and a certain compassionate modification of what Cassian is probably already seeing as excessive zeal on the part of some individuals, who are making of the monastic habit not so much a symbol of the quest for virtue, but a kind of an experience itself of suffering. He doesn't approve of that interpretation at all. If we move down then to number 3, very much, almost exactly like Evagrius, he believes that the hood of the habit is a symbol of simplicity and the childlike quality that one is to acquire. He then offers an interpretation of the tunics, which allows one's hands to be free, and as one can see in Evagrius, that's also a theme, that the free hands enable one to engage in the necessary labor. The cords, a kind of a set of strings or cords that come down on the habit, these are to make work all the more possible, to keep a full garment able to be bound up as is needed. And then, as one moves on down, again, exactly like Evagrius, the sheepskin is a kind of a reminder of the fact that one has cut off or one has engaged in the death and resurrection of Christ. This skin of a dead animal is a reminder of the fact that one is living out a life that is one with the death and resurrection of the Lord. The staff, in many ways, again, is a sign of the fact that one is supposed to carry the cross with one and never walk unarmed. So it's more, in a certain sense, of a weapon for Cassian than it was for Evagrius. If we then drop down to chapter number 10, in many ways I think that's probably the most important thing for us to be aware of, and that's his willingness both to teach about, that is to satisfy the curiosity and the eagerness and the longing on the part of his hearers to learn about the great monastic tradition of the past on the one hand, but also to remind them that it has to be modified according to the needs of the particular place in which monasticism has been implanted, in this case in Gaul. So he goes on to say that we've described all of the articles of dress which the Egyptians wear, but we need to keep to those which the situation of place and the customs of the district permit. So, okay, the Egyptians have symbolic meanings for all of these things, but we, he says, have to make sure that we wear what's appropriate for our life. The severity of a winter in France is not the same thing as what one would have experienced in a very dry, warm climate in Egypt. And so one needs warmer clothing. You can't be satisfied with very, very light tunics or with little shoes. And tiny hoods, he says, are, you know, kind of a silly thing in many ways. What would that mean to people? It wouldn't have the same symbolic significance for them. And he concludes, the chief thing about our dress should not be novelty of the garb, which give offense to some, but rather its honorable simplicity. So he's interested in both pointing out the symbolic value of what existed in an earlier age, but also emphasizing the particular virtue through application of the tradition to one's own life, of the central value of honorable simplicity. So this will conclude our discussion. Please feel free to read and also sort of jump back and forth if you wish using the embedded links between Evagrius and Cassian's material to see how Cassian is modifying and developing that which he received.